Well, let me say first how much I enjoyed reading your book, which puts the Declaration in context, but is also a close reading of the text, and that's something which American historians don't do too often, and that's something which I very much enjoyed. The context being, of course, as you put it, the world, and in a very convincing way, you show that it's not even within the United States, it's not an isolated document. It's, as you put it, it's a culmination of a series of documents. And you also bring light in a very innovative way, I think, to the influence not just of Locke, as you said, but Vattel, which has been indeed neglected by American historian. And that's very, very important on the notion of natural right and so on and so forth. Now, I'm not an historian of empire. I'm a political scientist by training. So what I'd like to do is three types of comments and questions. One regarding what I would call the French use of the Declaration of Independence, modern use of that declaration. Secondly, I'd like to consider some of the misuse or misreading of the Declaration of Independence by contemporary Americans. And thirdly, I'd like to go back to history to a particular question which on which I used to work, so I'd like to bring that back, which is the way the Declaration was discussed in France in 1789 by the Constituant, the National Assembly. So first, I'd like to refer to something that you mentioned, but without going deeply into that text, which is Derrida's 1976 conference that he delivered at University of Virginia with his particular reading of the Declaration. And that was, of course, at the time, that was the bicentennial of the Declaration. Now, you mentioned Derrida. It's a fascinating talk that he gave, which you can find today. It's printed in a book called Autobiography, O-T-O, referring to the ear, not the authors. And Derrida's talk is fascinating because he claims, at least, and I'd like to have your sense of it, whether you accept, you buy that argument or not, but he claims that here's a beautiful example of an undecidable document, by which he means, Derrida, that it doesn't say, the Declaration, whether independence is a fact already achieved and formalized in the Declaration, or whether it will take place, soon produce an outcome once it is adopted by the Congress. And in fact, we cannot decide between one way or the other. And it's both, as he puts it, descriptive and performative. Hence, Derrida's total fascination for a very short passage of the Declaration, which you do refer to, which is, you know, these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, are and ought to be. And Derrida sees that as a kind of literary, and not just literary, political coup de force. He could not have said coup d'etat, because the state wasn't. And with this undecidable question, which is the following, aren't the people already independent because the military rebellion has taken place before the Declaration? Or will they become independent thanks to the Declaration and its appeal to universal rights? Another question that I have, which is the reference to God, the Creator, in the Declaration. Now, it appeals the Declaration to a higher authority, or even, I would say, a chain of higher authorities, the laws of nature and nature's God. And this higher instance, and Derrida also refers to that, this last resort, if you wish, is what gives legitimacy in a way to the Declaration and what amounts to, and again, I'd like to have your sense of that expression used by Derrida, political military coup de force, he said. And in saying this, Derrida, in fact, I would say, shares an intuition which is very old and known of historians. You find, you know, Plutarch, more recently Rousseau's in The Social Contract, and also in the writings of the Federalist, particularly in Madison. And you find the same intuition, namely that if you're interested, as Rousseau, in the fathers of nation, if you're interested in a great legislator who creates a new society, of the lawgiver of the tradition in Roman time, Well, if Jefferson is a lawgiver or the Continental Congress a lawgiver, he has to invoke nature's God. The message is clear. The implicit message is that it's telling to the representatives of the people who are going to vote very soon on a declaration. You cannot fail to adopt this declaration, because to fail to adopt it would be to go against God's will. And of course, this is precisely what fathers of nation do in the social contract, Rousseau's social contract. They invoke God. They have to invoke a higher authority, or as Rousseau puts it, une autorité d'un autre ordre, to legitimize this coup de force, the founding of a new state. So I'd like to have your sense on this. You never use the term coup de force or coup, but close. I mean, isn't independence, the statement of independence, a kind of a coup de force, an implicit tabula rasa? And this leads to an observation regarding the modern use of the Declaration in the United States, or I would say the misreading of the Declaration. As you know, there's a vast American literature on rather conservative Republican literature, which sees the Declaration as the proof, if needs be, of that the United States is really a Christian nation, or at least a religious nation, and very often you'd have in presidential speeches, or even in some opinions of justices of the Supreme Court, Rehnquist or Scalia, numerous references to not just the Pilgrims, but the Declaration and God's creator in the Declaration. Or recently, Gingrich, who apparently just converted to Catholicism and is rediscovering religion. So we find in this emphasis on the Declaration's God, you find it, I think, in Samuel Huntington's, the late political scientist, several of his books, but Who Are We? Is the one I have in mind, where he talks about this American creed, which he kind of potpourri of civic Republican values and Anglo-Protestant values, and clearly in the American creed, the Declaration of Independence has a big part. And I think there's there a basic misunderstanding, and I'd like to have your sense again on this observation, of the nature of Jefferson's God in the Declaration. And I find, in fact, probably the best answer that I've read in American literature in a book that's not terribly well known by Walter Burns called Making Patriot. And he makes the point that the United States is not a Christian nation, and the God, the creator of the Declaration, is very much an Enlightenment God, a kind of grand architecte de l'univers à la Voltaire, and who has little to do with the Pilgrim's God, little to do with Winthrop's jealous God. Look, you know, Winthrop's journal, where he refers to the jealous God and who punishes men for their transgression and so on. You don't find that at all in the Declaration. Jefferson's God is a kind of fictitious Enlightenment God, and certainly not, as Burns tells us, the God of the Bible. That God does not command. No one falls from his grace. No one has reason to pray that God or to ask for his forgiveness. In fact, endows us, I cite Burns, with the right to worship other gods or no gods at all, end quote. And in fact, it gives us rights. Indeed, that's well, nature's right. But then that God disappears, and what we have is really government. So the world imagined by Jefferson is a world, I think, that's cut off from all transcending authority. It is instituted among men, as Jefferson puts it himself. It derives its just power from the consent of the governed, and that's it. So there is a higher authority somewhere, but it disappears, and the center is really the self-determination of people, hence the revolutionary nature of the document. And then you write, rightly so, I think it's a very important statement in your book, you write that the Declaration was a document of state-making, not nation formation. And that's very, I think it's a key point in your argument. You're absolutely right there, I think. But I'm afraid that it has become an instrument of nation formation, certainly in the hands of Huntington and other. And here, I'd like to point to those doubtful, here are the doubtful uses that I mentioned. Now, the Declaration offers a very radical message, and What's interesting is my last point. I would argue that in a way it was too radical a message for French revolutionaries, mm-hmm. particularly in the early phase of the French Revolution, at the time of the Declaration of the Rights of Man and before 1791, the time of the Assemblée Nationale, the Constituent Assembly. And let me try to explain what I mean by that. Now, you suggest, in fact, page 82, that the French paid little attention to the Declaration, with the exception of Lafayette, and that they paid much more attention to the American state constitutions, and that's very true. But I would argue they did not ignore the Declaration, and there are two interesting moments in French history when they rediscovered the Declaration after a long time after it is written. First one, 1786, the second one, 1789. Now in 86, 10 years exactly after the Declaration, and it's almost immediately published into French. It takes about a month, the gap of 3 weeks to a month. Translation, your talk to globalization, was remarkably fast at the time. Now, Demonier, in his Encyclopédie Méthodique, which is a very interesting document, I mean, it's huge, it ends up having 200 volumes, but the first four volumes are published between 84 and 88, and Demonier has 14 chapters dedicated to the United States, one for each state and one for États-Unis. And the article États-Unis is the biggest, 88 pages in the Encyclopédie Méthodique, and in that article you find, together with the article of the Confederation, together with Jefferson's bill for establishing religious freedom, you find full text of the Declaration of Independence. And with a comment that's kind of interesting, and I'd like to have your, to know what you think of this. Now, the comment is the following, and it's unsigned, it probably is Demonier, but maybe someone else. It could have been Jefferson, who also was involved in that work. Some of the accusation, notes Demonier, question mark, against George III were exaggerated in the Declaration. But it was good rhetoric, adds Demonier, quote, une ruse bien permise lorsqu'il s'agit de porter des peuples nombreux à une entreprise aussi audacieuse et aussi terrible. So, should I put it, a permissible ruse when you seek to bring to numerous peoples, in a plural, into such an audacious and terrifying enterprise. Now, in 1789, the Constituant did discuss in the National Assembly the Declaration. And of course, what they're interested in at the time is the second paragraph. That's what they're fixating on. For instance, July 11th, 89, Lally Tolentale, who was a monarchian, refers to the Declaration, which he sees as a declaration of rights, that's the way he describes it, and he points to the danger of imitating the American experience. He's afraid of, he doesn't want a detached declaration, detached from positive rights, detached from a constitution. Because if we start with the way the American did it, with the Declaration, and then many years later develop a constitution, that could be misread by the French people and demagogues and French leaders, and that could lead to, he says, confusion, anarchy, perhaps even civil war, to la subversion de toute autorité. So he sees the Declaration as an incredibly subversive text. But why is it subversive in France? Well, he says the following. A declaration of rights should be attached to the text of a constitution, which would specify the real nature and content of the people's right, presumably would limit the scope, in fact, of the Declaration. And he concludes, quote, there's a huge difference between a newborn people, by which he means the French, a newborn people which for eight centuries was attached to the same dynasty, and, quote, a colonial people that breaks away from a distant government. So that's the... And then August 1st, the same year, you have the argument of Malouet, who writes the following. In the United States, natural rights are fully acceptable because the American people already own land. They are no longer caught in a kind of semi-feudal system. He says, and anticipates Tocqueville, by the way, they already are accustomed to equality. So they are kind of a proto-democratic people, and for a proto-democratic people, the Declaration of Independence is fine. But in France, you cannot accept a detached, quote, metaphysical document, that's the way he describes it, because we could accept our Declaration of Rights, we can only accept it as long as it is corrected, modified by the Constitution. So there's this idea that you cannot let it go alone because it's too dangerous, too revolutionary a document. And if I may, last point, something which you did not mention in your talk, you do mention it in the book, but on 1848, the question of women's rights, the equality of women. And you refer to the 1848 Women's Rights Convention and the role of Elizabeth Stanton, Declaration of Sentiments, which is known to lots of Americans, but I guess in France we don't know much about that document. But in fact, what's fascinating, and the source that I use is a little known book, widely read in the past, but totally forgotten by historians, because it's not a good history book, nor is it good political science. But the book is Charles Beard, The Republic, Conversations on Fundamentals, a book that came out in 1943, a kind of late work and he rediscovers, I'm sure you know about it, this letter that Abigail Adams addressed to her husband, and just a quote, and I'll finish with that. Abigail, I long to hear that you have declared, she writes to her husband, an independency. And she writes that in March 1776, before the, and by the way, in a new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire that you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. And then she adds, if particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representations. So that there is also that interesting debate and very early debate about the rights of women, which exist even before the Declaration of Independence.